Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 61 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, a Second Amendment podcast that's a little bit for everyone. I'm Weirdbeard, and with me, as always, is my most excellent and very patient hostess, Aaron Paulette. How are you doing, Aaron?
So I just bought 25 token cards for my White Weenie Magic deck. So, you know, nothing to worry about. Nothing at all.
As in, like, tokens for as encounters?
Well, see, this is probably before or maybe after you played, but in Magic, there are certain cards which generate token creatures. Mm-hmm. You know, they're 1-1 or they're whatever, but they don't have a card, and you just... You represent them with little coins or pips or whatever. Mm-hmm. But some people, like myself, like having the card to represent them, especially if you have other cards which then boost them. So you know that this token is actually a 2/2. Mm-hmm. And so I went online and I found a place that was selling them for like 4 cents a card. And I go, you know, if I spend a buck, I'll have 25. That's a nice number. I don't think I'll ever need more than 25 soldier tokens, probably.
Aaron, I'm terrified to ask. But yes. Was it our offline blooper reel discussion of Magic the Gathering that...
Yes, that it was you bringing up the Fungusaur that did it.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Yeah, for those that don't subscribe in the blooper reels, there's a whole discussion where I made a reference to a Fungusaur, which is a Magic the Gathering card, and talked about my horrible, like, I have mentioned that I'm a former smoker on the show. I'm also a former Magic the Gathering person, and I guess I could say now that I have fallen off the wagon and now I've gone, like, I think it's like 3 years since I've had any nicotine in my system whatsoever. I will say that maybe the cigarettes were a little tougher to kick than Magic the Gathering. I thought maybe it wasn't, but either way, it was. They're on the same footing.
Yeah, well, at GRPC this fall, you're falling off the wagon, even if I have to drag you.
Oh, man. Oh, man.
You are playing with me.
I'll do it. I'll do it.
Hell yeah, you will.
I think I'll be okay. It's not like when Ryan Machad came down to my place a couple of weeks ago, he was like, "You want to bring a couple of nice cigars?" And I'm like, "You know what, man? Bring as many as you want. I will not be partaking because I am terrified that if I take a couple of puffs of a cigar, it's going to suddenly, the body's going to be like, ooh, nicotine, I remember you. I know just what to do. Let's go buy some cigarettes." Yeah, no, thank you. So, but I think I can resist the urges of Magic the Gathering. Plus, I've heard, aren't the rules like different now? Didn't they go through like a weird like change like around like 2000?
No, not around 2000. Probably closer to 2005 or
okay,
or later. Yeah, they've done some changes. I don't much remember. I mean,
I just remember, you know, a friend of mine playing it at the close friend of mine ran an anime and gaming shop and specifically encouraged people to play games in the shop because, hey, guess what? Because she also sold snacks and concessions. So mm-hmm. Guess what? Yeah, the longer you stay in the store, the more chances you're going to buy some product and the more chances you're going to buy some refreshments. And it's a good business model. Mm-hmm. Plus, it made the place a whole lot of fun just to go and hang out at. And, but yeah, people were playing Magic and I remember going, oh, what's going on? And everybody's like, yeah, no, they revised the rules a little bit. It makes the game a little bit more fast paced. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm not really sure. I know that they got rid of banding and, you don't have interrupts anymore. They're all instants now and maybe a few other things. I don't entirely remember. Hmm. It's not hugely important for our purposes.
Yep. As we geek out to the audience going, what are they talking about? I totally understood when Egghead was talking about the theremin, but this I do not get.
Okay, so let's talk about something that is actually relevant to the Second Amendment.
Okay.
So I think most of our listeners were, well, they obviously weren't listening to ACP, but They were probably listening to Gunblog Variety Cast. They were probably aware of when Bob Owens committed suicide. Mm-hmm. And that was back in 2017. That was a... God, I hate saying it's a very sad day because it's so childish, but it was. It was a sad day for all of us. Yep. And he ran Bearing Arms, which is... Well, it's a website. It might be an internet magazine. I'm not entirely sure where the definition of one ends and the other begins. But it is a place where you go to talk about guns and gear and Second Amendment-related developments. And so Bob died, and his partner, business partner, Jen Jakes, is that how you say your name?
Yes.
Jen Jakes was devastated, and... it's my understanding that she stepped down, and so the future of Bearing Arms was in question for a bit. Well, I have some very good news, both for fans of Bearing Arms and for friends of Cam Edwards, because we were concerned, you and I, about what would happen to Cam when NRA TV went under.
We were vaguely concerned.
Well, we knew he'd land on his feet, hit the ground running. But it's still always good to hear when a friend makes good. And I am pleased to announce that Cam Edwards announced himself that he was the new editor of BearingArms.com.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it is. And so I look forward to it. I mean, he's a lovely fellow, and he doesn't believe in controversy for the sake of controversy. One of the things I heard him say... I think it was when he gave his speech last year at Second Amendment Day, and he said something like, if I am the smartest person in the room, and he was talking about his TV show Cam and Company, if I'm the smartest person in the room, I've done something wrong. And so he didn't bring people on the show to trounce them. He brought people on because they had interesting viewpoints, and he wanted to learn from them. Maybe sometimes learn in spite of them if he disagreed with them, but he wasn't there to cause controversy, to be the TV version of clickbait. Mm-hmm. And so I am certain that he's going to continue that wonderful philosophy over at Bearing Arms, and I wish him well, because Cam is not only just a wonderful, decent guy in general, but he was very good to me in the early days of Blazing Sword. I mean, within about a month of us forming, he had me on as an interview, and that was my first national exposure. And I appeared on his show every year afterwards, and I have wonderful, fond feelings for him. And I am just so super happy that both a professional acquaintance and I consider him a good friend has done so well. And I'm glad that he got himself out of that. Well, it's not like he got himself out of the situation. NRA TV ceased operation. But I'm glad that he's no longer embroiled in that political mess. And now he can go back to doing what he does well, which is talking about guns and the Second Amendment.
Is he going to be doing any audio stuff? Because, oh, God, he cannot put that radio voice just away. Oh, God, he's got the best radio voice ever.
I'm not sure. But, you know, just for you, I will ask him and see if he will give you an interview.
That was my next thought is, oh, God, I so want to interview Cam Edwards.
I mean, he probably couldn't have done it before, but now I think we can, I think he'll be able to fit you in. He doesn't know if he's going to make it to GRPC. I hope he can.
Mm.
That'll be really, really cool. I make no guarantees, but I put in a good word for him. It's like, hey, if you haven't filled up your speaker slot, I know this guy. He's really good. So
you probably know this guy, and you know that he's really good. If you're a Second Amendment person, you know Cam Edwards, and you know he's good.
but yeah, I mean, that one speech he gave, and he was just natural at it, and he spoke for 30, 45 minutes, maybe an hour. I don't know. I lost track of time. And I asked him, I said, that was really good. When I spoke to you this morning, you didn't know what you were going to talk about. So you found time to write the speech. He said, nah. He improvised the entire thing. And it's like, I am in the presence of the master. Bow.
To be fair, we do hours upon hours upon hours now of improvised talking.
Well, yes, but I mean... I mean, he just did it cold, one cut. Yeah. Then again, he's been doing this for like 15 some odd years. So, you know, gosh, it's almost like he's a professional at talking.
Yeah. I bet you, like, if you got stuck, you've done enough Blazing Sword speeches and Pink Pistol speeches that I bet you that if you got pinched into a corner on the, oh man, can you come up real quick and do a Blazing Sword speech? I bet you could cobble a decent one together.
Yeah. Yeah, I could. I don't think it'd be as good as what he came up with, though. I'm sorry, I'm totally starstruck about the man. He's just a genuinely nice guy. Yeah. And when you find someone who is genuinely nice and kind and talented, it's like, yes, you. I want you to succeed at everything.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Plus, on top of that, I mean, just such a just unabashed stalwart defender of the Second Amendment is, I mean, it's, again, that's one of the big problems that we've got with the NRA is that I am very concerned with the leadership. Is the Second Amendment first still for you? You know, is or are there other things that are higher up on your concern list? Because I gotta say, you know what? If we don't have the right to keep and bear arms, we don't have the right to defend ourselves. What do we have?
So, speaking of the NRA, no, we're not going to go there. Don't worry about it. I recall that when you were at the NRA meeting with me and with our friend Oddball, that you were an enabler.
Yes. So every year at the NRA annual meeting, I stop by the Cabot Arm booths, both because, let's face it, 1911's made up to be pieces of functional art is just the thing I'm into. Like, oh God, they're so gorgeous. But also the president, Rob Bianchin, is a super nice guy, and he just wants to talk about all sorts of stuff. Last time we were sitting there talking, he's like, oh, you like to cook? Let's talk about cooking. And we're sitting here next to these like millions of dollars worth of 1911s, and we're talking about cooking.
You just had a nerd out.
Oh, God. It's, I mean, just there's so many nerds in that giant space. So a few years ago, this has actually got the whole cooking discussion going, is he was showing me some knives that he was importing. And I was super impressed. So I said to Oddball, hey, man, you got to go check this place out. And this year at the NRA annual meeting, they had a company rep showing off a bunch of their products. And believe it or not, Aaron, you might be shocked to find out that he bought a knife.
The hell you say?
Yeah. And he promised that when he bought the knife that he'd do a review on it. And so here is Oddball's review of the Sandarin TCK series of knives.
Welcome to Oddball's Corner Pocket. Me being me, one of the things I look forward to seeing at the NRA annual meeting is the knives. While there are usually major manufacturers like Benchmade and CRKT, there are often smaller manufacturers there. This year, Weird actually came and got me to take a look at one that has partnered with Cabo Arms. Sandarin Knives is an Italian company that is owned by a gentleman that comes from industrial manufacturing. Specifically, he has been in the business of making carbide cutting tools. He decided that he could make good knives with tungsten carbide, something that they claim is a first, and frankly, I can't think of anyone else who has done it. For those that don't know, tungsten carbide is very hard. It's sufficiently harder than steel that it's often used for drill bits and other tools for cutting into metal. It's also often used in mining drills and other applications where the tool will see a lot of hard use, and people want something extremely resistant to abuse. To give you an idea of the difference, with traditional blade steels, I typically don't recommend a hardness over about 61 Rockwell hardness, while the material in these blades comes in at about 71. And while talking to the owner, this was actually on the softer side of the metals that he deals with. According to him, there were concerns that anything harder would be too brittle. After talking to him for a while, and frankly drooling over his knives, I decided to buy one. He had two versions of one of their models with him, which was a very nice looking dress knife. The cheaper version, the TSK-416, had stainless steel handles, and the higher-end one, the TCK, had carbon fiber on one side and titanium on the other. I ended up going for the more expensive model. This is a knife that was definitely designed to go in a suit pocket. According to the website, it is only 0.17 of an inch thick without the pocket clip, and the clip means that it swells to a 0.39 inches. In comparison, my Spyderco Endura, which is pretty slim, is 0.4 inches without the clip. To go along with that thinness, the 3.25 inch Warncliffe blade is a mere 0.035 inches thick. I believe that it's the only knife in my collection where the material for the locking mechanism, in this case a frame lock, is significantly thicker than the blade itself. Oh, and weighing it 1.34 ounces, you will easily forget that it's there. The design and materials make it a conversation starter. The carbon fiber has been polished to an inch of its life and is really pretty. The blade has been likewise mirror polished and sports a series of holes drilled into it in a Doppler pattern. I've since found out that the diameter of the holes follow the Fibonacci sequence. The pivot screw and spacer are both anodized red, and this helps the knife be a work of functional art. Unfortunately, there are some issues with this knife. The first one is that it's set up for tip-down carry only. This really isn't a huge deal for me, but I know some people that have strong feelings about it. Second is that there is no retention detent. This means that while it does lock open, the only thing keeping the knife closed is friction and gravity. There is really no safety issue here if you're carrying it clipped to your pocket. Since it's tip down only, the act of reaching into your pocket will force it closed. If it was tip up, it could potentially open up on you. Lastly, this knife can't be opened one-handed. Granted, it is a light-use gentleman's knife and not some super tactical blade, but I've gotten used to there being some way to open my knife one-handed. Like with the tip-down thing, this is a design choice that you'll have to figure out whether it's important to you or not. So there is one question that comes up with this particular knife. It's a gentleman's knife that is clearly not designed for hard use, but is using a blade material that is generally used for hard use. Why would you pay more for such a thing? My answer to that is that I doubt you'll ever have to sharpen it. It comes out of the box hair-popping sharp, and it will probably stay that way for a very, very long time. Cutting envelopes, opening boxes, and cutting the odd apple just will not dull this thing. Also, tungsten does not react to the acids and fruits like steel will. I have used this knife for a while and shown it to a few of my friends that are also knife geeks. The only critic was a guy that is primarily into tactical and fighting knives, and he had to admit that it felt good in the hand and was so very pretty. Unfortunately, it's not cheap. The version that I have is currently being sold on their website for $299, and the steel-handled one is $199. And the fixed-blade knives, besides the kitchen knife that they sell, start at $1,500 and go up from there. There's actually one knife on there that is $150,000. That said, I would put this up against some of the $400 and $500 knives that I've seen from established manufacturers. Bottom line is that if you're the type that wears a suit often and wants a high-end, nice-looking, and functional pocket knife, you would not go wrong looking at the Sandrin TCK series. They also make them with gold and rose gold handles. And I'm pretty sure that Weird is seriously thinking about dropping the $160 on their kitchen knife. Oh, I should probably mention that while I did purchase the sample knife, the manufacturer did sell it to me for a deep discount if I promised to review it. I hope that this was interesting. If you would like to see more of my thoughts and hopefully pictures of this knife, I write at gunscarstech.com. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for future segments, I can be reached at oddball@gunscarstech.com or on the ACP Facebook group. Until next time, have a good one.
Yeah, that is the single most oddball segment I have ever heard. I mean, so many quotes that are just him. Like, yes, of course you bought a knife. Of course you bought the most expensive kind. Of course you know that you can shave with it.
And he is not quite 100% right. I am absolutely watching them for that dress knife for many of the reasons he said. The fact that I'm very much a utilitarian knife guy. I have a few knives that I consider my dress knives, but they are dress knives second, and just functional knives that just happen to be very, very slick looking as a secondary feature. But the big thing that I'm into is I absolutely want a kitchen knife for them. But right now, the only thing they're offering is a Santoku, which is essentially, for those that are into the standard knife terminology, it's essentially a gigantic sheep's foot. It's got a flat edge and no point. And I really want a knife that has a curved edge with a point to it for kitchen work, and specifically something that's kind of medium size. That's just what I want is a kitchen utility knife that's made out of their carbide, because Oddball didn't mention it, but like the reason why there aren't other people making knives out of carbide is because when you get things that are that hard, they tend to get brittle. And so, yes, you've got a carbide knife, and it's very, very sharp, and it's very, very hard, and it's very, very resistant steel, but you drop it and it's going to shatter like ceramic.
Oh,
but this stuff, like literally the guy was flexing the knife in his hands. Like, I mean, the knife is a wafa thin. I mean, they make it really, really thin, because I think it's heavier than steel. So they compensate so that they don't have it be just like pocket sinking heavy by making the blade very, very thin. And it doesn't matter how thin it is, because guess what? It's tough. But it has a lot of flex to it. Like, I mean, it flexes. I'm trying to think of what it was really flexing. Like, it was almost flexing like it was like a piece of Kydex or something like that in it. It's got a lot of bend to it. And that means that it's very, very resilient, and it's not going to chip, and it's not going to shatter like other tungsten carbide blades. And so, because of that, it's one of those like, oh my God, I want it, because I use ceramic knives in my kitchen as just my like go-to utility knives, because yeah, I'm going to go make a cocktail. Let me cut up some limes. And let me tell you, cut limes with a carbon steel knife, you need to wash it immediately. Otherwise it's going to start pitting and etching the blade, and you're going to lose your edge immediately. And you know, same thing goes with like anything that's, you know, if you're cutting meat or stuff like that, there's a lot of limitations to steel blades and that ceramic doesn't have, but then ceramic adds its own limitations. The fact that it chips and it'll crack on you.
And it's hard to sharpen.
It's impossible to sharpen as with these, but you really don't need it. I treat my ceramic blades as essentially long-term disposables. They usually last me there about a year, maybe two, and then they get enough chips and cracks in them that I just pitch them in the trash. I've never thrown one away because it was dull. I've thrown it away because it was damaged. So, and these knives are probably even harder than that. So, as Oddball said, yeah, you may never, ever need to sharpen these. Like, unless you're doing I found like videos online of guys like cutting like 1,000 feet of rope into like 1/4-inch slices. And then, yeah, the blade starts getting dull. It's one of those like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. That's okay. I just want to cut some limes up and maybe bone a piece of meat without having to worry about hitting the bone and chipping the blade and then getting ceramic in my cooking. No, thank you. So yeah, when they come out with a more Western profile kitchen knife, I don't care what the price is, I'm friggin' buying it.
Wow, you just completely nerded out.
Oh, God. I spend a lot of time in the kitchen. Did I mention the fact that I texted Aaron that Aaron saying it is 90 degrees outside and I've had my oven running all day long? I'm such a fool. My house does not have central AC, but I do have air conditioning in my house. And so there are sections of my house that are very cool and very comfortable. The one place that is never cool and never comfortable is my kitchen. And I spent an entire day when it was 90 degrees outside in my kitchen because the art called me. I am an artiste.
Okay. Well, you do you, baby.
I do me.
All right. So as I try to drag this back onto the highway of topics, have you ever traveled with a firearm? Do you know what you must do to comply with FOPA? David is here to tell us how to do it legally and what obstacles you might still face.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. As a follow-up to our LibertyCon roundtable and after-action report, I wanted to discuss some of the different experiences I've had myself or heard from others regarding travel with firearms. While some of this information has been discussed in some of my previous segments, I thought it appropriate to revisit this subject. A very important thing to be aware of when traveling with a firearm is U.S. Code 18, Section 926A, also known as the Interstate Transportation of Firearms section of the Firearm Owners Protection Act of 1986. I've asked that a link to this section of the law be included in the show notes. This federal law mandates that any person who is not otherwise prohibited from possessing a firearm is protected under law when they transport a firearm from any place where they can lawfully possess it to any other place where they can lawfully possess that firearm. This protection applies even if they pass through a place where it is not legal for them to possess a firearm, as long as the firearm and any ammunition is stored in accordance with this law, meaning that the firearm is unloaded, and neither the firearm nor any ammunition is readily accessible from the passenger compartment of the vehicle. Another very important thing to be aware of when traveling with a firearm is that several states ignore this federal law, most notably New York and Maryland. I know I've told this story before, but it bears repeating. When we moved from New York to Tennessee, my wife and I drove straight through with, amongst other things, my collection of handguns and all my ammunition. The handguns were unloaded and locked in a hard-sided suitcase, and the ammunition was stored in military surplus ammo cans. All of this was in the cargo area of the vehicle, in accordance with federal law. Driving through New York was not an issue, as I had a New York State pistol license. We avoided New Jersey and had no concerns with going through Pennsylvania. However, when we got to that 11-mile stretch of Maryland between Pennsylvania and West Virginia, the stress level ratcheted up. I was very familiar with the story of the Maryland Highway Patrol cuffing a man by the side of the highway and tearing his car apart looking for a firearm he didn't have. I shuddered to think what they would do to me. Amusingly, when we crossed the border into Maryland, everyone slowed down. It seemed like Maryland law enforcement had a reputation beyond the gun-owning community. 11 miles later, we crossed into West Virginia, and all the other drivers relaxed and sped up again. In many parts of the country, driving from one state to another with a firearm is not challenging. Simply check the Attorney General website of your starting or destination state for reciprocity or recognition, and head off on your trip. Another good resource is the handgunlaw.us website. I've asked our hosts to provide a link to this site in the show notes. While it's not super smartphone friendly, you can use this website to generate a map of where your carry permit is respected. This resource also has links to the different state websites. Always make sure to read the fine print and know before you go. Flying with a firearm introduces some different challenges and possibly a benefit or two. First off are the overlapping layers of regulations. The TSA has their rules for transporting firearms, each state where the airports are located has theirs, and finally, all the airlines have slightly different rules as well. I've asked for a link to the TSA page on traveling with firearms and ammunition be added to the show notes, as well as a link to the Delta Airlines policy as an example of that aspect. For Delta, it's listed under the Sporting Goods header on this webpage. Back when I lived in New York, one of my issues with flying with a firearm was that the process was slightly different each time. It always started the same way. I would approach the check-in counter and inform the attendant that I was traveling with a legally owned firearm. After that, I never knew what would happen next. On one occasion, they paged a TSA agent who looked at the handgun case but didn't open it to check inside. Another time, Albany County Sheriff's Department officers were called over and checked serial numbers against my New York pistol license. There were other instances that fell in between these two. When flying back to New York from Knoxville one time, I actually had to go buy a new case and locks because the case that had been passed by the TSA agent in New York was not acceptable to the TSA agent in Tennessee. When returning from Florida by air, they had me escort the cased firearm right to the door of the luggage area and wait until it was past a certain point before heading back up and through security myself. This is why I always leave extra time when flying with a checked firearm. Another issue that can cause delays is TSA shoe swabs. I'm not entirely sure what they're looking for with this process, but I've been told that one thing is explosive residue. From my own experience, and those of others I've spoken to, if this is what's being tested for, it's hit or miss at best. Following LibertyCon, a friend got hung up at the airport because he had an empty magazine in his carry-on luggage. While this was in direct violation of the TSA policy, which reads, "Firearm parts, including magazines, clips, bolts, and firing pins, are prohibited in carry-on baggage but may be transported in checked baggage." However, as he put it, because apparently a metal rectangle with a plastic base and a spring inside is a security risk. This is a valid point, especially when you consider that hand tools under 7 inches in length are acceptable in carry-on luggage. Much of this comes across as what another friend calls security kabuki theater. On an interesting aside, my friend who had the magazine issue lives in the western U.S. and has stated his intent to drive next year regardless of the distance, while another friend who lives in the southeast is leaning towards flying so as to avoid the long drive. Everyone has their own cost-benefit analysis. For many, the balance is time versus energy versus cost versus luggage quantity and type. I'm sure there are other considerations as well. Once again, if you plan to travel with a firearm, do your research before you leave your home state. The key phrase is always know before you go. That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments or a comment about a past segment, please post them on the Assorted Calibers podcast Facebook page and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
Oh, man. I loved his point on the fact that every single time I fly with a firearm, it's different. Pretty much. Like, I've done it enough now that there's been a few times where it's pretty much been the same. But yeah, I'm amazed at the... Actually, leaving Indiana for the NRA annual meeting, I got a new one, which was they checked my firearm. And they gave me a piece of paper or something and told me to go to a security office on the other side of the secure area and essentially introduce myself to the TSA guy there. And essentially there was like a little like cubicle just on the other side of the scanners and such. And I just went over and just went, hey, I was told to give this piece of paper to you. He goes, oh, yeah. And he picked up the phone and gave a call and goes, how long ago did you check in? I don't know, like 15 minutes. Yeah, it's not quite long enough. Why don't you hang around for a little bit and all? Essentially, they were going to call me back at some point to do the check because sometimes they make you open up. Like, actually, the first time I flew with a firearm, it was actually hilarious, is the fact that I just laughed so hard in the fact that they escorted me back to the TSA checkpoint and had me open up the case. And then the guy looked at me and just said, is it unloaded? Yes, it's unloaded. And that was it. He took my word for it. And then he used his hands and pushed all around. It was a pistol case, pushed all around the pistol, feeling and just checking the case everywhere. Didn't check the gun, didn't really bother, like made sure not to touch the gun, but touched everywhere inside the case just to make sure that, I don't know, I wasn't smuggling drugs or uranium or whatever through the TSA. It's kabuki theater. It's foolishness. We should all just be able to John McClane. I get a carry permit here. My carry permit's recognized on the other side of the thing. Let me carry on the plane.
Oh, jeez. And then there are the people like Annette Evans who regularly have problems, like problems, as in, you want me to do something that is illegal. Here, I will provide you with a printout from, I don't know, Homeland Security or TSA or whatever. It's like, look, here are the actual rules from your company. You don't believe me. Great. Call the police. I'll wait. And because she's a competitive shooter, she flies with her gun or guns a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And she gets all sorts of trouble.
Yeah, I can only imagine on just the various things. Like I've never had anybody ask me to try to, like, thankfully everybody has. The closest I've got was at one point I was flying to one of the NRA annual meetings. No, I think it was, no, I was flying back because it was Logan. I have never had a problem. Logan has always been the easiest place that I've ever flown out of. Because I don't know. They just like, you've got a gun. Cool. You just get away. Get as far away from me as you can. I think I was flying back from, I can't remember where, but somebody got, I opened up my pistol case and there was my 1911 and I carry two magazines in my mag pouch and one in the gun. And that's just how I loaded them up into the gun case, is there were two empty magazines sitting beside the gun and one empty magazine inside the empty pistol. And there was a box of ammo in the bag. And the person looked at it and says, is it unloaded? Yes. And they recognized that there was a magazine in the gun and they're like, there's a magazine in the gun or clip in the, I can't remember what term they use, but they essentially clip. They stated that they were uncomfortable with the fact that they saw that the magazine well was not physically empty. So I actually ejected the magazine out to show them that there was no ammunition in the magazine. And that was the closest I ever got to handling a firearm in an airport. And who knows? Hopefully it won't get that way. But boy, I fly with a gun a lot as well. Probably not as much as Annette.
So, segueing from Logan Airport to another Logan we know, when I was at the University of Mary Washington's Second Amendment Day up in Virginia earlier this year, I had the pleasure to meet Logan Medish, who, well, I mean, I didn't really know who he was at the time, but he was talking about historical firearms that were made in Virginia. And so I knew he was a historian of some sort. And then later, when we all went out to dinner, I discovered that he didn't anymore, but he used to work at the NRA Museum. And so when I knew that he was a historian and he got to handle some of the guns in the museum, I just knew that Weird would want to talk to him. And so when I got Logan's card, I handed it over to Weird and I said, you probably want to interview this guy. And to be completely honest, I thought you would interview him for Handgun Radio because I thought you would geek out about, you know, moldy old revolvers or whatever. I'm really surprised that you spoke to him for this podcast.
To be fair, we've got a Handgun Radio show in the works. But yeah, so
you just spoke to him for hours, didn't you?
It was probably a hour. But yeah, when I contacted him, he was very interested in doing the show. He was super excited about it. So I said,
you're welcome.
Yeah. Is there anything in particular you want to talk about? And he said, I'm open to anything. Those are some dangerous words. So I thought about it for a little while, and I thought a great subject to talk about, specifically for this show, is the works of John Patterson. So joining me now is arms historian and proprietor of High Caliber History, Logan Medish. How you doing, Logan?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you today?
I'm doing great. So Erin met you out in, did she meet you in Salt Lake City?
No, we met in Virginia, okay. At a thing called 2A Day at the University of Mary Washington.
Yes, yes. I couldn't remember which one of her travels she met you on, but she spoke the world of you. So I reached out and asked if you wanted to be on the show, and you said you would. And I said, anything particularly interesting to talk about? And you literally said, anything you want to talk about. And
that's right.
Yeah, for those that know me, especially those who listen to Handgun Radio, you know that old moldy firearms are a bit of a fetish of mine. And so yeah, that's not a good thing to say. You turned me loose in a candy store. And so I kind of racked my brain a little bit, and I said, how would you feel about talking about the works of John Pederson? And I say that because I'm a 1911 guy. I'm carrying a 1911 right now. I love John Browning. I will speak the world of John Browning. But in the world of John Browning, it seems that always right there in his shadow, and I would say almost to the point where far too many people have no idea who I'm talking about, is John Pederson.
Yes, absolutely. And it's such a linked relationship between John Pederson and John Moses Browning, you know, as we'll get to as we go through his career. But it's hard to argue with John Moses Browning. You know, you can't really argue with a man whose middle name is Moses. But he once said that Pederson was the greatest gun designer in the world. You know, you stop and think about that for a minute. You think, my God, John Moses Browning said that someone else was a better gun designer than him. And he said that mainly because at the time in his life when he was making that comment, that he had pretty much done all of his inventing and Pederson's career was ahead of him. And they paralleled their careers in a lot of different ways, in that John Moses Browning did a lot of his work with Winchester, focused most of his stuff, you know, just at one company for the vast majority of his career. And John Pederson did a very similar thing, but with Remington. And there's a lot of his designs ended up getting picked up by Remington. There's some military attempts in there, but really the main undertone to it all is Remington. And that's where the bulk of his work comes from. And so he's coming out with a lot of really innovative designs. Definitely one of his coolest designs and the most successful designs was what became the Remington Model 12, which was a pump action 22 gallery rifle, if you will. Incredibly popular design in the early 20th century at different shooting galleries and carnivals and things of that nature. And a staggering number of those guns made. You know, they made more than 800,000 of them, which is no small feat. I mean, that is a testament itself to the popularity of that design. And so that's his rimfire design. But then he wants to go on and compete in the centerfire market. And so the natural gun that you're going to have to compete against in that time frame is going to be the Winchester 1894, which, of course, is a John Browning design. So there go their professional careers intertwining with one another. And so they beef it up to a centerfire design, and the Model 12 becomes the Model 14. And so he's known mainly for his long gun designs, and we'll get into his Pederson rifle and stuff like that. Well, you know what? Actually, let's get into his Pederson rifle right now.
Yeah.
His Pederson rifle is a really neat design, in that it's got a toggle lock action, kind of like a Luger pistol, which is something that you don't really see or think of being an effective design on a long gun, but that's what he incorporated into his gun, and he came up with his own cartridge as well. It was the 276 Pederson, and in order to get those all to feed properly, they actually had a wax coating on the cartridges so that they would feed and extract properly. And it's important to keep in mind that this is around the same time where John Garand is creating what becomes the M1 rifle. And so these guns are kind of neck and neck in trying to figure out what is going to be the next gun.
I mean, it's my understanding that the Pederson rifle directly competed with the Garand.
Yes, it absolutely did. But here's where the military goes for cost savings, and you know they're replacing the M1903 and M1917 bolt action rifles, which were 30-06, and of course the M1 rifle is also in 30-06, and so it became a no-brainer kind of for the military to look at it and go, well, we've already got a ton of this particular caliber laying around. Why should we switch to a firearm that is a totally different proprietary cartridge? And so government being government, it just made most sense for them to switch to what becomes the M1 rifle, John Guerin's design, and to avoid the Pedersen design, to have to deal with all sorts of retooling and new ammo manufacturers and things like that.
And I got to understand with that extraction issue that the gun had, so that it needed that wax coating, it probably couldn't be rebarreled into something else. Because, I mean, there's a ton of popular military rifles that started out in calibers that you might not expect. But this was probably not one of those that could be easily adopted to another cartridge.
Yeah, I think the design was specific enough that, you know, if he felt the need to come up with his own cartridge to go with the design, I think that probably speaks to the design. You know, I think if John Pedersen felt the gun could have operated proficiently and to its full potential in 30-06, he probably would have chambered it in that cartridge. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't know for sure, but it seems that would make sense to me anyway. But so because it doesn't get that military contract, the gun's fairly rare. He ends up licensing the design to Vickers over in the UK, and they only make about 200 of them. So if you ever come across a Pedersen rifle or even a Pedersen cartridge, you know, they're both cool, and gun guys tend to be cartridge guys too, and there's a lot of cartridge collectors. But it's a neat design, and it just unfortunately didn't really go anywhere. And that's both a testament to how his career goes in general. He's right there on the cusp, but never quite makes it. But it's also a testament to John Guerin and his rifles, because Pedersen ended up creating in very small numbers, like less than 25 or so of what were called the GX and GY rifles. And they were basically straight up copies of the M1 rifle with a few different tweaks to the design that he thought would improve on them. But, you know, it didn't go anywhere. That didn't make it into a military contract either. So it's, again, just one of those things. Even though he was a powerhouse, he kind of sits in the shadows of Browning and Guerin. And so it's a little unfortunate for him. But, again, he still has a fantastic career. He's mainly known for his long guns, but he also developed some handguns as well. Primarily the one that he's most well known for and that will tend to be in the forefront of people's minds because of Remington's botched attempt to reintroduce it.
I'm glad you said it.
Someone had to say it, right? But so a few years ago, you may remember that Remington tried to reintroduce the Model 51, R51. And things didn't go so well for them. But the original R51 in 380 and to a lesser degree in 32 was actually a very successful handgun in their lineup. But it doesn't catch on and it doesn't have the staying power that some of the other guns did in that time frame. And it certainly didn't carry well into the 21st century when they tried to redesign it and keep the same name. But an interesting aspect of that R51 design, the original design, mentioned that it was chambered in 380 primarily, but they redesignated the R53 when they introduce it in 45 ACP. And the goal for this is that it's supposed to compete against Browning's 1911. And he finally gets these guns up and running and everything squared away in 1917, hoping to get some military trials, and it goes well for him, but it's too little too late. You know, we're already in the throes of World War One. We've got all these companies that have tooled up to create 1911s.
Yeah, this was already after the acceptance. This was not part of the original trials gun where the 1911 went up against the Savage and the Luger.
That's correct. Yeah, the trials had already been concluded years before, and so it was too little, too late. It took him a little longer to get things ready for prime time, if you will, and he just kind of missed the boat and didn't get things in order fast enough, which is unfortunate because the military enjoyed the gun. They really thought it was a good design, but again, it just didn't quite hit the mark, and he's just a little behind the eight ball on that, as he was with a lot of stuff in his career, which is terribly unfortunate for him because he was such a fantastic designer. And Pedersen's career is an incredibly long one. And if you know anything about him, you know that there's some really interesting, influential pieces that we haven't covered yet. But I'm watching the clock here, and I see that we're running a little long on time. So if you know what those guns are that we haven't talked about, well, then there's your little sneak peek for our next segment. And if you don't, well, I'm going to leave you hanging with a pretty cool cliffhanger. So make sure you tune in next time to learn about the rest of Pedersen's career.
Oh, thank you so much, Logan. This is super interesting stuff. I can't wait to keep talking about it. So that's Logan Medish from High Caliber History. Thank you so much, Logan.
Thanks for having me.
Wow. So, okay, I know that you're going to disown me, but I actually hadn't heard of John Pedersen until right now.
That is the whole point of this, Aaron. I'm not going to disown you. That is exactly the reason why I wanted to do this one.
Oh, okay. I mean, I thought it was a case of, you know, a lot of people knew about him and kind of a well-kept secret or something. I don't know.
If you are geeky and into historical stuff, specifically if you're like the type of person who pores over the various trials, and you know that Savage produced a 45 ACP gun based on their 32 caliber guns, you know, that was going up against the 1911, then you probably know who John Pedersen was. Or if you happen to be diving into the whole ill-fated Remington pistol, you might know who John Pedersen was. But otherwise, no, he's really someone that is not super well known, but has a really amazing career. So that was exactly why I picked this.
So I remember the R-51 debacle. And so it's very curious to me that I never heard of John Pedersen, because I knew that they were revamping an old design. But let me tell you, and I can't give you a good reason why, but the moment I saw the R-51, I hated it. And it was just, it was the same reaction I had to Matt Smith when he became the Doctor. It was like, I have no reason to hate you, but I hate you.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it was just, everyone was going nuts. It's like, oh my god, an all-steel pistol from Remington, and they're bringing back this old classic design, and it's so cool. And I'm just going, it's ugly. Okay, whatever. So it warmed the subcocal area of my heart when people were going, yeah, it's kind of ass. It's like, aha! My completely unjustified bias was in fact justified after the fact.
Kind of ass? It was total ass. It was all the way butt. Yeah, no, it was nice to have it be the fact that it was single action. It was small. It was single stack. It's set up very, very nicely for carry. It really fit a niche that is kind of been neglected in the pistol world. Like, at least has been neglected for like 70 years. So, you know, the type of people that, you know, I mean, there are people out there right now carrying like Colt 1903s, because why not? I've got one. It works. It's a great carry gun. Yeah, John Browning designed a great carry gun with that. You know, is it the most modern gun on earth? No. Does it work? Yeah, absolutely. Says the guy who carries a 1911 nearly every day. But
so there are people who still carry 32 cal? Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Why not? Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of the round, though. Actually, we did a show on Handgun Radio where we were talking about those weird, like, cavitating Phillips head type bullets. And yeah, supposedly they work. They really, really work. and they work well enough that they translate very well to like 32. So one of the things we talked about was possibly there might be a resurgence in 32 ACP. Don't know.
Huh. Okay then.
Yeah. Yeah. I certainly would, again, for those who listen to Handgun Radio, one of the things I always say is I really want to see North American Arms scale up one of their mini revolvers just enough so that it'll fit a 32 ACP, because I think that is a perfect caliber for that gun, because they're all designed around like 22 caliber. But man, scaling it up to 32, it's 32 isn't much, but when comparing it to 22 long rifle, it's quite a step up.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. So just the idea. And again, they're teeny tiny. I don't know if you ever handled or shot one.
I have not.
They're almost so small as to be completely impractical. I mean, it is, you really have to think about how you're going to hold on to one when you shoot it. And the recoil is incredible for even something like 22. It is a handful, even at 22 long rifle, just because it's so tiny and you've got so little to hold on to. But the idea to scale it up to something like 32, so it's still something that's very small and it's still something that's relatively manageable, but now you're getting into a center fire caliber. But yeah, either way, the R51 was harkening back to a design that kind of went by the wayside, especially with the striker fired pistol revolution of the 80s.
Okay then. Sorry.
Here comes the Handgun Radio guy geeking out. And on that note, I will exit stage left. Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcalibers podcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of our podcast plus bonus content like the hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film tracks, and the ACP mag dump. You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com, and hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
Well, you know, I'm kind of all over the place, and I'm, very popular, so I think I will not plug the different places I am, and if you know where to find me, then you go where to find me, right?
I'll have you know that Aaron Paulette is best enjoyed with a fine Armagnac.
With a what?
A fine Armagnac. It's the drink and
learn. The fine Armagnac? What?
Armagnac. It was stated by the Drink and Learn podcast as Cognac's sluttier cousin.
Okay. I'm willing to give that a try.
Thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
He geeks out about kitchen knives and antique pistols. I geek out about Magic the Gathering and My Little Pony. Our nerddoms are associated, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.